Hey, Tom here. Welcome to the Hack Podcast. You're going to hear something pretty interesting happen on this show. A very big, breaking and surprising story from New South Wales unfolds during the program. And as you'll hear, it involves one of our colleagues at the ABC. Also on the podcast, there's a new sporting scholarship for something you might not even consider a sport. Maybe you'll be eligible for one of these scholarships. You'll find out what that is in just a moment. Plus a deadly civil war you might not have heard of.
Hack. In a statement, reporter Ashley Raper says Mr. Foley put his hand through the back of her dress and inside her underpants.
Triple J.
First to a story very close to home for us here at Triple J's Hack program. Just this afternoon, one of our peers, a young ABC news reporter, has revealed that she's the woman who was allegedly assaulted by a man who was months away from potentially becoming the New South Wales Premier. That man is Luke Foley, who is expected to resign at any moment. This controversy started 3 weeks ago when David Elliott, a New South Wales government poly, said this from across the chamber.
I tell you what, I haven't had a little bit too much to drink at a party and harassed an ABC journalist. I've never done that.
Now, since he said that, speculation has been building about exactly what he was talking about, what happened at that Christmas party with an ABC staffer in 2016. Well, now we know who the alleged victim is and we know her version of events. It's Ashley Raper, an ABC news reporter, and she released this statement just a few hours ago.
This is a position I never wanted to be in and a statement I never intended to make. But I think the time has come for my voice to be heard for the following reasons. The escalation of public debate, two recent phone conversations with the leader of the New South Wales opposition, Luke Foley, to set the record straight.
So her statement goes on to give her account of what happened on that night in late 2016.
Later in the evening, Luke Foley approached a group of people, including me, to say goodnight. He stood next to me. He put his hand through a gap in the back of my dress and inside my underpants. He rested his hand on my buttocks. I completely froze. This was witnessed by Sean Nichols, who was then the state political editor at the Sydney Morning Herald and is now an ABC journalist. Mr. Foley then left the bar.
Yeah, it's an intense statement, and she went on to say that she actually got a call from the New South Wales opposition leader over the weekend, and he said he was going to resign over this, and then he rang her again on Tuesday and said that he's changed his mind and he wouldn't be resigning, and that's part of what pushed her over the edge to speak out. Now, Kathleen Calderwood is an ABC news reporter. Kathleen, is Luke Foley going to resign this afternoon?
That's what we're expecting. It's imminent as far as we understand. I'm actually standing outside of his office and the press, a large amount of press is gathered inside waiting for him to come in. So all the information we're getting through is that he will resign, yes.
Does that mean he is acknowledging that what she has alleged is true?
I think that's probably the million-dollar question, Tom. Obviously, since the statement was released earlier today, there's been mounting pressure on Luke Foley to resign. We've been hearing from Labor MPs who were saying they were shocked and appalled to hear of the allegations. And one MP did come out saying that she would be calling a spill if Mr. Foley didn't resign. So the main question we'll be asking him if he does resign is whether this is an admission of what had happened.
So given where polling's at in New South Wales, if this hadn't happened, what chance did he have of becoming New South Wales Premier?
That's a really good question. I think it was probably still a little bit up in the air. Obviously it doesn't seem like he's got much of a chance now, but I think, 5 months out from an election, he probably could have stood a good chance without this coming to a head.
All right. Well, we can see the cameras lining up at a media conference there in New South Wales Parliament right now. Luke Foley hasn't walked into the room, but as soon as he does, we will bring you some of that press conference. Kathleen, thanks so much for joining us there.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, you are listening to Triple J's Hack program. Moving on from Ashley Raper's story and Luke Foley's political future for just a moment to a story of someone who wanted to tell their story of sexual assault but actually isn't allowed to.
The outcome of it is that it actually gags victims, meaning that we can't have a Me Too movement in Tasmania or the NT.
On Triple J.
Tasmania is silencing sexual assault victims, which means it couldn't have a Me Too movement of its own. That's according to NRAPE on Campus, a sexual assault survivor advocacy group. So what's going on in Tassie? Well, Tassie and the Northern Territory are the only parts of Australia where the law stops you from putting your name to your story of sexual abuse if your case has gone to court. Now, this unusual legal situation has come to light because a young Tassie victim wants to put her name to her story but can't, unless she seeks a court order by proving her story is in the public interest. Now, Nina Fennell is campaigning to change these laws. She's from NRAPE on Campus, and she started a campaign called Let Her Speak. Nina, thanks for joining us on Hack.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Why is it so important for sexual assault victims to have the freedom to tell their stories and, importantly, put their names to their story?
Well, I think if people want to tell their story, it can be a really important part of reclaiming a sense of power and control and ownership over what's happened to them. I mean, I've spoken out personally about my own experience of sexual assault, and that wasn't just cathartic, it was actually quite healing, and it was my way of being able to let my perpetrator know that he had not won, I'm not defined by his actions, and that my choice to speak out is one thing that I can control.
So why does Tasmania and the Northern Territory have laws that prevent people from doing it?
Well, in theory, the laws were put in place to protect victims from media who might try and exploit them for their stories. But what we've actually found is that it actually protects the perpetrators because it means that the victims can't speak out and say what's happened to them. So I think it was well-intentioned to begin with, but the outcome of it is we can't have a Me Too movement in Tasmania or the NT, and those victims who do want to speak out are effectively being told by the courts that they're not allowed to.
So, Nina, you've been speaking to a young woman who's a victim of sexual offences. What's her situation now?
I've been speaking to a young woman who I'll refer to as Jane Doe. Jane Doe was 15 when she was a victim of sexual offences. She's now 23 and she's ready to speak out in full about what happened to her. But because of this really archaic law, she's not able to speak. And if she does, if anyone names her, they could face prosecution.
So she could get a court order that would allow her to speak if she could prove that it's in the public interest. Has she done that yet?
She's exploring that option at the moment, but what you have to realise is that to go through that process is really time consuming and really costly. So when you've got a victim who's already gone through sexual offences as well as the criminal justice system, to then expect them to go through an additional court process, it really just penalises and punishes the victim.
And are these laws just essentially existing in theory, or have people actually been prosecuted for telling their story?
No, publications have been prosecuted. There was a case in 2012, for example, where a Tasmanian publication named a rape survivor with that survivor's full consent and cooperation. But because the publication was in breach of this law, they were fined $20,000. And obviously that sets a pretty concerning precedent for other news media in Tasmania and the Northern Territory that they could get fined as well.
So what are you doing to get these laws changed?
So today we've launched a campaign through NRAPE on Campus called Let Her Speak. We're campaigning for the rights of all sexual assault survivors in Tasmania and the Northern Territory to have the law changed.
Okay, we reached out to the Tasmanian government to ask them what's going on, and they said they are considering this law. Do you think they're going to change it?
I certainly hope they will change it. There was a report 5 years ago in Tasmania into this law that made similar recommendations, and yet they've really sat on their hands and haven't acted since that time. So we're hoping that having so many survivors from across the country come together to say, this is important, this matters to us, that might be enough to convince them to finally take action.
So you've said Tassie couldn't have its own Me Too movement. Are you saying that laws like this that suppress the stories of victims mean we won't see as much positive, broader societal change on issues like sexual assault?
That's exactly right. I mean, every time we get a survivor who comes forward, it gives people courage to report to the police or to the media or to counselling. So we need some of these public-facing role models to give others the encouragement to also come forward and report.
So what impact does it have on society to hear those stories and have those people identify themselves as they tell those stories?
I think it does a few things. The first thing is I think it really helps to break down the stigma and the shame around sexual assault. I also think it deepens the public's understanding of sexual assault, the causes, the consequences, the impacts. But also I think it starts broader conversations around topics like consent or victim blaming. And that in turn has really, really positive flow-on effects for the survivor community more broadly.
Nina, great to speak to you. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Hack. Triple J.
That was Nina Fennell from NRAPE on Campus.
Hack. Mohammed Kaiman is MD and condemned police for wrongfully accusing him of writing plans in a notebook to kill former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull and other politicians.
On Triple J.
You are listening to Triple J's Hack program, and we've been closely following the story of Mohammed Nizamuddin on Hack. He was that 25-year-old Sri Lankan guy who was a student at New South Wales Uni. He was a model student until 2 months ago. He was arrested on terror charges. It was alleged he was plotting to assassinate Malcolm Turnbull and Julie Bishop, and his face was even plastered on the Daily Telegraph at the time with the headline, Poster Boy for Terrorism. Well, it turns out, as we know, that the evidence was flawed, and 3 weeks ago the charges were dropped. He'd already spent a month in solitary confinement. Now, finally, he's spoken out about his experience, and in a statement he gave from back home in Sri Lanka, he said, "The method in which the AFP conducted themselves was completely immature, unprofessional, irresponsible, embarrassing, and biased, to say the least. I strongly believe this happened because I'm an Asian on a student visa, and the AFP had the wrong impression that I did not have the resources or capability of defending my innocence." All right, now, the New South Wales former opposition leader has just spoken in New South Wales Parliament, and he's resigned over sexual assault allegations. Here's what he had to say.
"The first thing I'd like to say is that the allegations against me today, made public by the ABC, are false. I've retained solicitors and senior counsel to advise on the immediate commencement of defamation proceedings in the Federal Court of Australia. However, I can't fight to clear my name and fight an election at the same time. It's just not possible to do both. Therefore, I'm resigning the leadership of the Labor Party effective today. This will enable a new leader to give his or her full attention to the task of defeating the Liberal National Government. I'll be remaining as the member for Auburn and returning to the backbench. Thank you."
Did you call Ashley and say it was true?
Why not take questions?
Did you agree to resign?
Wow, so that was a press conference, very dramatic, very short as well, from New South Wales Parliament. You had the Labor leader, or former Labor leader now, Luke Foley, saying that he refutes the claims made by ABC reporter Ashley Raper, and that he'll be fighting them in a defamation case. But he said that whilst fighting that, he can't be the leader of the opposition and lead his party to victory in next year's state election. So huge news there.
Hack. A Saudi-led coalition has for the past 4 years been bombing Yemen.
Triple J.
Now, when we asked 11,000 of you in our What's Up in Your World survey, you told us that you care about what's going on internationally and that you're pretty informed about world affairs. So you probably know about the civil war that's been raging in Syria for the last 7 years, but there's another civil war in the Middle East that might have flown under your radar. For the last 3 years, there's been a civil war going on in Yemen, which is on the southern border of Saudi Arabia and looks across the Aden Gulf towards Somalia and Eritrea on the northeast African corner. The situation in Yemen is getting worse. On average, one child dies every 10 minutes, and half the population is at risk of starvation. So let's find out what's going on and what role we, Australia, are playing in this conflict. Here's Shalila Medora to explain hell on earth.
Yemen right now is hell on earth for children.
Juliet Toomer works for UNICEF, the UN's fund for children in Yemen. Via Skype, she tells me about the things she saw when she visited a hospital on the front line of Yemen's long-running conflict.
You could hear the sound of bullets, you could hear the sound of bombing, and as the days went by, that bombing has intensified. In a hospital in Hodeidah, we are fearful for the fate of 59 children.
Yemen is pretty much the worst humanitarian crisis we have today.
Aussie aid worker Jason Lee has been working in Yemen for Save the Children for 1 year. He's safe. He's in a part of the country that isn't ravaged by war. But he's got a front seat view to an unfolding humanitarian disaster.
Basically, the conflict started in 2015, but it's getting worse, particularly with the escalation and fighting around Hodeida.
Overnight, fighting got worse in Hodeida, a port city that's crucial to the running of the country.
And about 90% of all commercial goods come through the port. So that's pretty much everything from food, fuel, water, anything you can imagine comes through this port. Now, since June this year, there's been an offensive on recapturing the city.
The fighting at this key port means not only a shortage of food, but that no aid can get in either.
14 million people, so half the population of Yemen. That's more than the combined populations of Sydney, Melbourne, Canberra, I imagine, and probably even Brisbane, that are at risk of famine where they have no idea where their next meal is coming from.
Malnutrition is particularly bad amongst young children.
Almost half of the children who are under 5 years old are malnourished. In Yemen, every 10 minutes, a child dies from preventable causes.
And just when you think it can't get any worse, there's been a recent outbreak of cholera, a waterborne disease that causes severe diarrhea. Here's Dina El-Mamoun from Oxfam.
More than a million people are suspected of cholera, or more than 2,000 have died.
To get your head around why Yemen's at war, you need to understand a little bit about where it sits in the world. Yemen is in the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula in the Middle East. It shares a border with Saudi Arabia and is close to Iran. Yemen is the poorest country in the region.
Before the conflict, we already had food insecurity. We had a situation where water was scarce.
So when a wave of protests called the Arab Spring rolled through the Middle East and Africa in 2010, Yemenis decided they wanted change too. A group of rebels called the Houthis unseated the Yemeni leader. In 2015, Saudi Arabia set up a coalition of Arab nations to fight against the Houthi rebels. The Houthis are Shia. That's the type of Islam mostly practiced in Iran. And Saudi Arabia is majority Sunni.
Saudi Arabia considered the Houthi actions an immediate threat and feared this could be an opportunity for Iran to gain a foothold on their border.
The two branches of Islam have been at it for like 1,500 years, and Yemen is the latest hotspot.
Now, the poorest country in the Arab region has become the violent playground for regional and international powers.
But before you dismiss this war as religious violence amongst Muslim nations, consider this.
Now, what we want to do is make sure that we export more defence technology.
In January this year, Australia announced its intentions to become one of the top 10 exporters of defence technology in the world.
What this is doing is for the first time establishing a solid, continuing Australian defence industry in Australia.
Among our biggest buyers, Saudi Arabia.
It seems surprising to me that a country like Australia that has the background and the value system that we do is actually wanting to be involved in the perpetuation of wars and conflicts. It's baffling for me.
Hack on Triple J.
Jason Lee from Save the Children, and in our report from Shalala Medora. And if you want to know more about the conflict in Yemen, including how you can help, head to the Hack website and there's an article there with all of that info. Now, Shalala's story raised a very interesting point right at the end there. Is Australia involved in weapons export to Saudi Arabia that end up in Yemen? Well, Dr. Roger Shanahan is a Middle East security expert and a former army officer who served in Afghanistan, Syria. He's also worked in Saudi Arabia. He now works for the Lowy Institute. Roger, thanks for joining us on Triple J.
Yeah, my pleasure.
The death toll from the Yemen conflict seems to be disputed. There was a UN estimate of 10,000 deaths from about 2 years ago, but the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project puts it at 57,000. What's your estimate?
Listen, I don't think we should concentrate on figures. Yeah, it's in the tens of thousands, and I think that's really all people need to know. We can get wrapped around death tolls. You know, any death toll in that of that magnitude is obviously a tragedy.
So are Australian weapons ending up in this conflict?
Well, not that we know of, and I think we have to be very careful when we talk about defence exports, that the majority of defence exports, particularly Australian defence exports, are neither weapons nor ammunition. Part of the problem, though, is getting oversight of exactly what is being exported to Gulf states. But, you know, just on economies of scale, they tend not to buy the kind of weapons systems that Australia manufactures because they prefer integrated systems that are exported by countries like the UK, the US, obviously, as the major exporter, and potentially France.
Okay, so do you feel like there's any problem with, I guess, Australia's exports and the way our weapons are involved in any conflict?
Well, again, you know, you have to define what a defence export is. You don't default automatically to everything that's been exported by defence is automatically a weapon or a weapon system, or it's going to be used for nefarious purposes. There's a whole range of defence exports, from services to radars to defensive systems to trucks. You know, so you have to be very careful about what you're talking about when you're talking about defence exports.
If the conflict in Yemen isn't resolved soon, where do you think it's headed? Could it escalate? Could it spread? Could it cause conflict amongst the nations that are involved in this conflict?
No, listen, I don't think so. And I think one of the elements that's probably misconstrued and that was included in your broadcast there, when we're talking about the Shia-Sunni divide, we have to be very careful. The Houthis sect of Zaydism, which is an offshoot of the Shia faith, and it's certainly not what is practiced in Iran. Iran is giving support to the Houthis, but it's not ideological support because the two religions are quite different. What Iran is giving is support to it in support of its national aims, not any kind of ideological aim. And so what we're seeing is middle power competition, not a kind of extension of a Sunni-Shia conflict.
Incredibly complex, isn't it, Roger?
Absolutely, and this is part of the problem. It's a remote area. It's never been particularly well governed. Corruption and misuse of agricultural resources and a range of other things has been long been a characteristic of Yemen, and once you get middle power or regional power competition and a conflict, as we've seen, an incredibly difficult geographic area to fight a conflict in, then the kind of tragedy that we're seeing unfolding at the moment is there for all to see.
All right, Roger Shanahan, thank you for making that complex Yemen conflict a little clearer for us.
My pleasure.
That's Roger Shanahan from the Lowy Institute.
Electronic sports or esports have changed the way we compete.
On Triple J.
Well, now to the new sporting scholarship for an unexpected sport, esports. Yep, computer games. The Queensland University of Technology is offering 5 students 10 grand scholarships for their new esports team. So is this where uni should be spending their money, their scholarship money? Is esports really in the same league as other sports like basketball and footy, or is this just a marketing ploy for a technological uni? Well, there's been an esports demonstration at the Asian Games. The Olympic Committee's been considering whether esports should become an Olympic sport one day. So maybe one day we'll drop the E and just call it sport. As Stephen Stockwell reports, the esports scholarship takes us a step closer.
They've really got behind us in a serious way.
Dylan Polis is the co-founder and co-coordinator of QUT's eSport program. This arena, The Room, opened in July, and the uni pays staff to run it to help fly students to competitions. And now there's an eSports scholarship.
It's an inclusion of eSports in the broader sports strategy at QUT. It's not a special kind of eSports scholarship.
Well, it kind of is. QUT is the first uni in Australia and potentially the world to be awarded a spot in the League of Legends Semi-Pro Challenger Series for 2019. Dylan will manage that team, the QUT Tigers, and the scholarship is there because he's pretty serious about winning.
To really show that, we wanted to attract the best talent at a university level, and the best way to do that, we thought, was through scholarships.
5 students will get 10 grand over the course of their degree to be part of that program, which will see them get access to sports psychologists, the gym, specialist training, all that jazz. Dylan's saying this isn't a special esports thing because they'll actually be awarded under the elite athlete category of the Vice Chancellor's Scholarship.
The skills that young people learn in traditional sports, you play cricket, soccer, rugby from such a young age, and you're learning teamwork, leadership, communication, all of these really important social skills. Esports teaches people exactly that, and they do it for kids that might not have otherwise fit into that traditional sporting model.
This all sounds pretty sweet, but it's a long way from how sports is usually thought about at universities. I was a bit sus on whether or not this was just some marketing gimmick.
No, I don't think it is. If it was a gimmick, I think they would have just thrown it out there and then waited for the community to form under it. But they really waited for the community to form, the students to get behind it, have a strong, solid base before they got in and helped us out.
As OG, the Nimbus Sam, the shockwave from Sam.
Esports is coming on in a really big way. More than 300 people watched competitive games last year, and that's estimated to double by 2020. There's a lot of money involved too. The top players make millions, and the biggest prize pool for the Dota International this year was $25 million.
Your TIA champions!
The pro scene in Australia isn't at the level it is overseas in places like Asia and the US, but it is growing.
The scene is getting bigger and bigger everywhere in the world. It's starting to become mainstream for everybody.
At the back five computers of the QUT eSport Arena today, there are a bunch of dudes working together. They're a Counter-Strike team, practicing for a comp on the weekend.
I've just always played video games since I was young, and I've, you know, always been competitive about things I've done.
Is esports a legit sport?
I would say so, to be honest. Like, in a game like Counter-Strike, you have to put so much, work into it and concentration.
It's an interesting one, actually, and coming from a professional sort of athletic background, I've spent a lot of time thinking about it, but I think it is.
Emily Rosemond is the sport coordinator at QUT, looking after the elite athlete program, club developments, and now esports. She comes from a more traditional sport background, cycling and speed skating. She's a Commonwealth Games medalist and Winter Olympian.
There's a lot of parallels that we can see, you know, in terms of the pressures involved, you know, from a cognitive level to that of professional sport.
QUT offers up to 30 sports scholarships for 10 grand. And while esports will now take up 5 of them, Emily says that's all part of a new targeted approach.
Obviously, we're refining our sports program and obviously some of the smaller sports and sports that don't fall into our targeted approach may miss out, but we're essentially looking at making sure that process in selections is very clear and transparent and fair.
So we're hoping that the arena that we have here, the program that we're running here, can be like a lighthouse for all the other universities in Australia.
Dylan Polis, the co-coordinator of QUT Esports, says there are other unis that have been in touch and that they're keen to set up similar programs. He reckons it won't be long before there'll be university esport leagues around Australia, like in the US, that pave the way for hopeful pros.
Every year we'll see more universities get on board, and there'll be this tipping point where you're not considered a good university if you don't have an esports program. It's going to be like traditional sports. If you don't have a social rugby club and a proper rugby team, cricket, soccer, you name it, you're kind of like, are you supporting sports at this university? Esports is going to fall into that category.
Hack with Tom Tilley, Triple J.
Dylan Polis, the coordinator of QUT Esports. And yep, the news is that they have an esports scholarship program. All right, back to our big story of the day.
Hack. Triple J.
A man who was working towards becoming the New South Wales Premier has resigned today. Here's what he said.
The allegations against me today, made public by the ABC, are false.
He was the centre of sexual assault allegations made by an ABC journalist. He has responded to those by saying he will sue for defamation. He disputes the allegations, but he won't be continuing on as the New South Wales opposition leader. Kathleen Calderwood is the ABC news reporter on the spot for us. What did you make of that reaction?
Well, look, it was a bit of a shock, obviously, after the statement that's come out today, which had some very specific details. There'd been mounting pressure for Luke Foley to resign. So when we heard that he was going to resign, obviously, the first question is that an admission of that he's done what he said, was alleged, I should say. As you heard there, he resigned, but he denied the allegations. He said that he's employed lawyers and he is looking to immediately commence defamation proceedings. He didn't specify as to whether that was against the ABC or against reporter Ashley Raper. However, he said he's going to resign from the leadership of the Labor Party. He's going to remain as the MP for Auburn and will return to the backbench in the New South Wales Parliament.
Well, she said she made this statement because she wanted this to be over. It's not going to be over now, is it?
Doesn't sound like it, Tom, unfortunately. So I guess it's anyone's guess how it will play out from here. But yes, Luke Foley has resigned as the leader of the Labor Party, but it doesn't sound like this will be the last we hear of him.
Yeah. Wow. All right, Kathleen Caldwell, thank you so much for joining us, ABC News reporter. A very poignant text. It's much easier to prove defamation than it is to prove an assault. Our laws mean that a powerful man can intimidate and financially ruin a woman who dares to speak out.
Hack.
On Triple J.
All right, that's all we had time for. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast. I'll catch you tomorrow for the Friday Shake-Up.